Session number 8230.
Major Rathbone, take three. You were going to tell me another story, weren't you?
About Lucy Wickham Hall? Well, the other occasion when he saved things for his side was after the Suvla landing. As everybody knows, that was given to General Sir Freddy Stopford, who was elderly, infirm, crippled leg. And the landing was muddled, admittedly. Troops got mixed up, divisions got mixed up, there were two divisions. All the same, some effort should have been made, as was made clear in the GHQ orders, to get possession of the heights ahead. No effort was made. For about 48 hours, the Ninth Corps did nothing. Mustafa Kemal, having learnt about the landing, was very quick to see the implications and rushed reinforcements forward to all the threatened heights. That was the second occasion when he saved the Turkish side.
Because there was a change of commander-in-chief, wasn't there, at Gallipoli?
Oh, there was, yes. Sir Ian Hamilton was commander-in-chief nearly all the time. And then Lord Kitchener was sent out. I think the cabinet were glad to get rid of him. Anyhow, he was sent out to report on whether there should be an evacuation or not. It's a little hard to make out from the histories whether he reported in favour or against. His personal inclination was to hang on. But anyhow, it is eventually decided Sir Ian Hamilton was to come home also to report. And General Sir Charles Munro was made Commander-in-Chief and immediately sent in a report in favour of evacuation. He was afterwards Commander-in-Chief in India.
You described your respect for the Turks. Did you ever meet the Anzacs, the Australians and New Zealanders?
I met one or two of them on Lemnos. After the evacuation, we spent a month on the island of Lemnos, and there were some Australians and New Zealanders there. I met them individually, but I never had anything official to do with them.
How about the French or Indians? Did you meet...
I never met any of those.
Are there any outstanding British people you saw on the peninsula? Your commanding officers, for
yes,
instance.
Could Colonel you... Fairley. He was a delightful person. He was one of the few regular officers that were posted to the 6th Battalion at the beginning of the war. And he was second in command to start with. Then I forget who our CO was at the Chunuk Bair disaster. But he became commanding officer after that and continued as such until he was killed in April 1916 in Mesopotamia. Very fine man. Of course, I had a tremendous admiration for General Maud. Do you want to hear about him now? Because it was after the beginning of the blizzard.
Oh, perhaps you could tell us now about the blizzard, would you?
Yes.
When did this happen?
This would be 6th of November.
26th of November.
We've been greatly cheered by the arrival of a case of supplies from Fortnum and Mason. And I, as mess president of our company mess, had ordered a six-course dinner. But we didn't get far with it. After about two courses, the most tremendous shattering rain I ever remember came down, thundering down, very soon broke through our flimsy dugout roof, mess dugout. And we were all soaked. Well, as I've said, we were lucky in being on fairly high ground. But the fate of the 39th and 40th Brigades on our left and the 2nd Mounted Division on our right were pitiable. Many men would drown and died of exposure. It was a ghastly shambles. My platoon was in company reserve, and I was ordered to turn it out and do what I could to drain this swirling water out of a certain trench. When I got there, I found my men feebly trying to shovel out the water. I realized it was no good trying to do it that way and jumped into the trench, followed by my men. And we toiled and managed to, I suppose we did some good. Anyway, at an early hour in the morning, I got back absolutely chilled and wretched to find that my dugout was also had collapsed on top of my kit. So I sort of stood about wondering what to do. And then I heard a cheerful voice. I saw a red glow near me. I heard a cheerful voice say, "Would you like a cup of tea, sir?" This was the battalion headquarters cook's dugout, which had not suffered the fate of my... I went in and was greeted with kindness and cheerfulness. "Give him a good strong cup." "Ah, a Lancashire cup." So I had this hot tea, marvellous. Well, to continue about the blizzard, the next day, the Turks were wandering about. They were in the same sort of plight as we were, and there was a sort of undeclared armistice. No firing, nothing. And whether it was that day or the next, I'm not quite sure. But General Maud came up to the trenches with, I think, three staff officers. You couldn't move more than two men without getting shelled across the Salt Lake. And his appearance was a real tonic. He was a guardsman, winking buttons, horse chestnut boots where they weren't covered with mud. Faultlessly turned out. And nothing could have exceeded his kindness, courtesy. He found out what our needs were. He did his damnedest to fulfill them. It must have been difficult because evacuation had already been decided on and a lot of stores had gone. Well, we all felt the better for his visit. And he followed it up with a message. "Tell every officer, NCO and man in the division, how much I admire the splendid pluck, bravery and courage in the face of this vile weather. Tell them that their conduct adds luster not only to the reputation of those fine old regiments whose names they bear, but to the British Army. I'm trying to send up more coal. Also coke. I'm authorizing a fresh rum issue tonight. General Maud." Well, it arrived on the usual pink flimsy, and I well remember, wrapped in a ground sheet, going round all the dugouts and trenches, reading it out to the men. That night, I think it froze, and our blankets became stiff like wooden boards.
Did you have cases of frostbite with weather like that?
Yes. The next thing that happened was a tremendous reinforcement. Do you want to hear about that? Well, we woke up one morning, as I say, after this frost. We must have looked a sight. We hadn't shaved for about 3 days. And suddenly we heard cheerful voices outside. Officers with polished Sam Browns, neat uniforms, the like of which we hadn't seen for goodness knows how long. The reinforcements we'd had hitherto, the last month or two, amounted perhaps to one officer, two officers, and 30 men, that kind of thing. This was of the order of 10 officers and 500 men. And it was the same throughout the division. It created a very difficult accommodation problem. There was nowhere to put all these people. And you couldn't parade men in numbers more than about half a dozen without risking shelling, loss of life. However, we enlarged the dugouts, we built new ones. We took over even more deserted trenches of the 2nd Mounted Division on the right. And somehow we got them all sorted out. And the next thing that happened was the evacuation. We were officially told about this time that we were to be evacuated. Orders to leave nothing behind of any sort of value to the Turks. Even the sandbags had to be slipped with bayonets. We did our best to comply. And the orders were that we marched down to the beach in parties, so there would always be an efficient rear guard in case the Turks got wise to it. Well, I remember it was the 19th of December, dawn bright and clear. And I suddenly thought, how nice our battalion headquarters looks on Green Hill. And I had very strongly that feeling which Masefield later put into words in his admirable little book, Gallipoli. No man does anything consciously for the last time without a feeling of sadness. It seemed a pity to be leaving it. However, we got going, there was a bright moon. We left all sorts of devices in the trenches, candles and string to let off a rifle. And for the last few days, one gun had been doing the job for, and that kind of thing, so as to keep up a perfectly normal volume of fire that it always had been. Well, we got down. I remember passing a huge dump of food supplies, which was there in case we didn't get off, and which was also mine to go up in smoke after we'd gone. Well, we got into lighters, and away to a small ship. This was marvellous because it had luxuries such as razor blades, chocolate, cigarettes. We hadn't seen a cigarette for 3 weeks. Hot water and soap to wash in. We didn't know where we were going. The next morning, we arrived at Imbros and disembarked there. There was a hot meal ready. And I think, yes, that same day, we got into another ship and went to Lemnos, where we spent the next month. I remember being very angry when the news came. Helles wasn't evacuated till a fortnight later. But the news of the evacuation of Suvla and Anzac was in the papers. And the Times said, the troops concerned are, of course, the Australians and New Zealanders. What about the 5 British divisions at Suvla Bay? Not a mention.
What were your feelings on being evacuated?
Well, mixed, you know, as I said. I was sorry to leave our old bits of trench where we'd been for so long. And yet it was exciting, the evacuation, plans for it and everything. and the weather helped, and then going on to a lighter and a ship, and a sudden change to comparative luxury from what we had to put up with, and the wondering what we should do next.
You did achieve complete surprise, did you not?
Yes. Turks never had an inkling about it.
It would sound a very well-planned operation.
It was exceedingly well-planned.
Better than a lot of the military operations, the planning for that, it would seem.
Yes. We seem to be rather good at that sort of thing. Considering the conditions, Dunkirk was well-planned.
It must have been very miserable on Gallipoli towards the end, in that very cold weather. Did you have any sort of means of heating at all?
Well, as I tell you, General Moore did wonders. He sent up braziers and coal and coke and sheepskin coats. It's absolutely marvellous. Oh, yes. Besides, the weather improved after that frost.
Didn't men actually lose fingers and toes with frostbite? Or were they treated in time, do you think?
I think mostly they were treated in time. There's no case of frostbite of fingers coming off that sticks in my memory. That's not to say it didn't happen.
You mentioned a message coming up in a pink flimsy. What is that?
Oh, you don't know what an army message form looks like. Well, it's a thing about that size, you see.
About 5 by 7.
And there's a top white thing with various headings, date, number, and so on, and a carbon copy, which is usually pink. I don't know, at least it was then. I don't know why. That's why I said a pink flimsy.
Could you tell me some more about this sort of secrecy of the evacuation? Did you have very strict orders that you must keep up the pretense that things were going on as normal?
Very strict orders indeed, detailed orders, yes. And about the destruction of stores.
Was that difficult to do, did you find?
No. We were very naughty in our company. We got hold of some rum and put it in some sort of container and filled it up with paraffin. No, in a rum jar, you see. So we hoped the Turks would take a swig at that.
Were you well supplied with rum?
Yes, not too bad. As I say, in that message I read out, I'm authorising a fresh rum issue tonight.
Was that a very important, that message, do you think, for the men's morale?
It's very hard to say, because one didn't question them about it. But my impression would be, yes, it was.
It seems to have been for your... You seem very impressed with General Maud.
I am. Besides, that wasn't my only experience of him. He took the division to Mesopotamia, where he became first corps commander and then commander-in-chief. Tragically, he died in January 1918 at Baghdad. It was said after drinking some milk at a Jewish festival of cholera. But his handling of affairs there was perfectly splendid, too.
Yes, I'd like to ask you something about that later on. Because you would have been at Lemnos over Christmas, would you not? What
yes.
sort of a Christmas would you have had then?
You know, I honestly can't remember that. I don't know why. I can remember certain things about Lemnos. I can remember a tactical exercise we did with the company. But Christmas, I suppose we had tinned turkey and plum pudding. I know we had another blizzard on Lemnos, not as bad as the Gallipoli one, but pretty severe, blew down tents. And some wag tried to imitate General Maud's message about it.
What were your relations like with your men, would you say? Did
Good.
You find you forged very close relations under those conditions?
Yes, I think one did. I dare say I made the mistake of not forging closer ones.
What makes you say that?
Oh, I may have had an exaggerated idea of officers and troops. But I mean, the best officers remain officers, but have a very good understanding with their men. I think mine might have been better.
You were very young, weren't you, yeah. And inexperienced, yeah. Then. And I suppose your training would have led you into, you know, perceiving that difference between the ranks. Is that not right?
I think so, yes.
Was it a valuable experience for you, Gallipoli? Did you find you learned lessons from it?
That's awfully hard to say.
It's very fresh in your mind, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think on the whole, yes, certainly. You were asking about relations with troops. My servant, Private Small, I met him later at the Combined Infantry Depot in Bangalore in India. I'd been evacuated after my second wound from Mesopotamia. He received me with broad grin and said, I was telling these chaps, I was his servant on Peninsula. Oh, once you on Peninsula, then nothing better than a recruit is these chaps. So I had good relations with him, all right.
Do you belong to the Gallipoli Society Association?
Yes, I do.
What do you think of it?
I haven't been able, owing to these unfortunate operations, to be at any of their dinners or anything for some years. I was at the last one, I was at one, the Duke of Edinburgh's guest speaker. I think it's a good thing. This Peter Liddell I've told you about hasn't much opinion of Major Bannon, who is chairman, secretary, and editor of the Gallipolian, which comes out once a quarter, I think. But I think he's done a very good job, I must say. I think Peter Liddell accused him of being an elitist. Well, I'm an elitist too. That doesn't ipso facto prove you.
So you think it's a good thing, the association?
Oh, yes. It was nice talking to those chaps at the dinners I have attended. Craggy faces, resolute faces. The only pity was I only managed to find one chap in the 13th Division.
Your losses were very high, weren't they?
Hmm?
Your losses were very high.
Oh, yes. First at Chanakpur and Gallipoli, and secondly at Saniyat and Mesopotamia. Can I say this? I took a photograph the day after the armistice with Germany, when we were at a little place on the LFC in Mesopotamia, of the men who had been in the 6th Battalion, Loyal North Anchor Regiment, in Gallipoli, what we used to call Taud 6, the old 6th Battalion, the original 6th, people who had enlisted in the 6th Battalion in 1915. There was a sergeant and 6 men. It wasn't really too bad, that. Could hardly have been matched in France, I don't think. We were the only division that never saw France.
But that would have been out of how many, a sergeant and 6 men?
Well, a company would be 150 men. Attendance in France, the time of the Somme, for instance, was 6 weeks. We so very nearly succeeded in the Gallipoli campaign. At least 3 times. I don't think, but I may be wrong, that any of the attempts at Helles to capture Achibaba could have succeeded. But the attempt to take Chanakpur at Anzac, which overlooked the Narrows, very, very nearly came off. It can be blamed on all sorts of things, guides losing their way, people being split up into columns instead of maintaining the corps and divisional and brigade organization. I wasn't there, so I can't speak from first-hand experience. But if only it had been possible to reinforce those few men, Captain Ellenson and his Gurkhas, and a few of the 6 Lower North Lancashires, and I think a few of the 6 South Lancashires, then we would have succeeded. Then there was Suvla Bay. If a younger and more energetic general had been appointed to command the 9th Corps, if tremendous energy had been exercised by the 2 divisional commanders, if they'd insisted on